Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. Today, we're joined by Joel Harrison, a true pioneer in B2B marketing. In fact, he co-founded B2B marketing franchise, and now he is a host of Trust and Influence in B2B, a podcast. Joel, welcome to the pod.
Hey, Alex. Lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me on.
So, Joel, the B2B marketing framework of various events you organized, like once in UK, once in US. I was fortunate to be a speaker at one of yours in London, is really a franchise where you get people to really deeply learn about the content and all the latest trends and changes in B2B marketing, which is different than the typical conference where people kind of show off and do their thing. Like, I really felt like people were committed. What do you think is there's unique in both how you approached it and what's the need of in the market that you've seen for people to dive in and understand the depth of what's going on in B2B?
Well, it's first of all, it's worth just clarifying. So I founded a company called B2BMarketing.net, as you said, 22 years ago, which I'm still a co-owner of, but I'm not operationally involved in at all these days. Hence, my podcast is a wholly owned thing that I do, where I can kind of follow my own creative journalistic instincts around what's interesting. So there's still an owner of B2BMarketing.net and the Ignite conference and the Global ABM conference and all those things. I was heavily involved in their creation and their development. And I was a kind of program manager for years, so I know events inside out. But these days, day to day, I'm not so involved. But in terms of the kind of format, which hasn't really changed that much, very important. We always felt to try and give people the kind of real practical guidance, but also inspiration about what's going on, what people are doing, because B2B marketing is evolving really fast. It's evolving faster now than it ever has in the past. And so you want to hear what's going on. You want to hear the kind of warts and all perspective about what people are finding, how they're approaching particular challenges. You know, the good news, the bad news, the good, the bad, and the ugly, I suppose. That can come from vendors if it's done properly. It's better if it comes from marketers because it's a bit more honest or probably a bit more kind of candid. Often a synergy of the two works really, really well. So getting that perspective is vital. But I think above all of that, one of the things that's so inspirational, so heartwarming and fantastic about coming out off the back of one of these events, and we did one in July, beginning of July, so just over a month ago now, is that is the sense of community that you get. And marketers love coming together, and some of the anecdotal conversations and connections that people build at those events are fantastic. And you know, it's not a free event. We kind of curate the agenda very carefully, so that there are other kind of less curated conferences on the spectrum, or ones with an explicit agenda, or ones where you're basically paying to play and there's not really any curation involved. Mm-hmm. You know, you can get some level of insight there, but the kind of like that once you're in the door and Ignite or Global ABM conference, there's just a level of sharing and a mutual respect and engagement and energization you get, which is just gives me, it puts me in a buzz for about a week afterwards.
So that's brilliant, Joel. If you're thinking from a community perspective, and you know, obviously your podcast is about trust. It seems that like the prevailing challenge right now in the B2B world is, you know, it's easier to create content. We all, you know, maybe not the highest quality content like your podcast or you know, us talking here, but generally the cost with AI, the cost of creating something is reduced. But the complexity actually increases of many offerings. It's easier to create products. There's more products. Large B2B companies, I think, are not streamlining their portfolios last time I've seen. And so there's just a lot of noise, complexity. So how does the community play in trust? And then let's expand more around what are ways in which you can build trust through conversations, through content, and beyond?
Yeah, I mean, the complexity is all about B2B. That's one of the key differentiators from B2C, right? Because it's at every level, at a product level, at a buying level, it's super hard. So I guess that, and I think that often tech companies will try and simplify it at a focus on the products, and they won't actually focus on the brand and what you stand for. So it's about building your brand, or building your reputation, I should probably say, because brand, when you start talking about brands, there's people kind of default to talk about advertising, and that's one tool in the marketer's weapon armory, but it's not the only thing we should be doing. So
you're separating brand from demand type of, so we like a lot of people confuse those two.
No, I think they separate that. I think they confuse those, because I think that demand generation activities is all about something you can measure towards and contribute towards a sale, whereas brand is more about visibility and awareness. Whereas what I'm seeking to try and do, and I had not thought this through fully or understood this, but a number of smart people I'm talking to try and distinguish between brand and reputation. And I think those are, because I think if you start talking about brand, it tends to be a conversation about advertising to a greater or lesser extent, whereas actually I think the broader topic of reputation is really important, and that's where things like some of the other metrics to the build that reputation and trust really in some ways better bedfellows, and that's where some of the other things that interest me at the moment are kind of coming in. And to the second part of what I think your question was around what mechanics, what techniques, what metric, what things can you do to help build that? Well, for me, the kind of, I'm looking at that kind of canon of trust in terms of five kind of protagonists that can really help you build that trust. And there's a thought leaders, and that kind of falls into the bracket of thought leadership, but these are individuals who are notable in their points of view. There are employee advocates, who are people who are perhaps less with a point of view, but more with kind of kudos and a resonant voice that you can empower and you can deploy and enable and engage to communicate with customers and prospects. There are unpaid influencers, people like journalists or analysts.
So just to pause on that for a second. So the employee, this is basically your thought, like your team that's not in the sales position is actually sharing their thought leadership, their best practices, and they're more trusted than the LinkedIn, you know, post coming from your company website, because this is an individual, they have their reputation, they wouldn't just say stuff to sell stuff.
Well, I would just to be clear on the nuance, there's the thought leaders are the people with a point of view who are going to have unique perspectives and high levels of expertise and knowledge and be respectable and respected and visible. And then there's the more the rank and file employees who perhaps not in those positions of authority, would perhaps never want to be, maybe more junior, maybe more functional in their roles, but influential at a granular level, and need enabling, need giving the facilities, the license, and the ability to go and communicate, and kind of smart companies. I did a great podcast episode with the reader Oyabadi from Workday, and she was talking about that, about her work there. So that's fascinating. Those are the first two personas. Then you've got unpaid influencers, who are people like journalists and people like analysts who are in the market, who are within the firmament of the industry you're in, and they are people with influence and with visibility, but you don't have a transaction with them to get them to say something. Then there are paid influencers, right? So you can pay to amplify your message. And then lastly, there are customer advocates. So those five protagonists, I think, are really critical in terms of enabling you to build trust. And what I find increasing is that their engagement with integrated campaigns, the thing that we spend most of, marketers spend a lot of time thinking about, a lot of money focusing on, they're often, agencies aren't very orientated towards those personas. They don't understand them, they don't recognize them, they don't deploy them as effectively as they might be. And yet those five protagonists can be the most powerful voices in the armory, in a brand's armory, partly because of the proliferation of brand messages that's coming as a consequence of AI and of social media changing. So leveraging that is those humans and the just kind of ongoing trend towards humanization, that for me is where the future of B2B marketing is.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I think everybody recognizes that the easiest sales opportunities are the ones where a customer refers another potential customer in, right? Because it's sort of, hey, this there's already, you know, this background conversation happened where they said, hey, we had this major project that we couldn't complete in any way, and my job depended on it, and these guys came in and helped it. And but the underlying issue is we don't have enough of those leads, right? Like that's sort of like everybody wishes we had more of these types of referrals. And then partner and other influencers, it's kind of maybe slightly next level, but they may have more distribution horsepower, right? And so it's kind of balances out between their trustworthiness, because hey, I've used this myself, versus like, this is cool, you know, check it out, you know, but then I have a big audience, so like, you know, it spreads. Is that kind of one way of thinking about these five?
Yeah, it is. And they play different roles at different stages of the buying journey, right? You know, your point about customer advocacy, yes, it's very powerful. It's a hard thing to do. Few companies have kind of processized, systemized, or automized it. And you're starting to see consultancies and technology vendors setting up and able to do that and to kind of create it as a flywheel. Otherwise, what tends to happen is that you'll have one salesman will have one good concept and they'll start overusing them, and then that actually just pisses them off, you know. And then that's, apologies for my language, but you know, it's kind of becomes a kind of like a cottage industry almost. Whereas actually, where what we're starting to see is this becoming much more scalable and robust as a discipline, as something which can therefore make an impact. Otherwise, you'll get random acts of customer advocacy where someone might just happen to know, you might have a former colleague who happens to use that company. You'll look on LinkedIn and see if they've used them before, if they've worked with them. So that's all good, but again, you can't build your business around that, right? That's stuff that is supportive in an anecdotal fashion. What's exciting now is that we're starting to see this. There's this real momentum build up because there are people that are enabling you to do it at a more industrialized level.
One of the things that I love that I noticed in our experience at Relate2 is like I don't even have a term for it that's precise, but it's basically customer generated content growth. So an example is a customer of ours generates a report, you know, publication, a guide. With our platform. And that is, you know, if it's not designed for individual sales processes, it's designed for marketing or some other broader communication, it gets exposure to some peers, right? Like as a good example, investor relations officer at a competitor always scans what their peers are doing on their investor relations website. And so they go and say, wow, you have this great interactive asset, like that seems to be working. And then they come. That is so much easier to have that conversation when they've seen a peer or competitor use the product. And this process is scalable because we actually don't even have to ask the advocate to do anything, right? They're just by publishing, they're doing the legwork. Have you found more example, like maybe we're unique because we have a publishing kind of externality that benefits us. But is that something that you've been seeing as well, as kind of a scalable way up to approach this in other companies you work with?
Yeah, I've been approached to do similar things like that. I haven't actually done it directly myself, partly because I've been B2B marketing as a company has the relationships like that where they will you know, work as an advocate or they will kind of do a level of kind of creating some of the reviews, maybe not form a report as much as that, but I've been invited to be to work commercially as with an organization, a software provider, if I like the tool, saw a use for it, and they're cool, could authentically advocate for it. And I think that's tremendous. It's by somebody that I hugely respect, by the way. I'm not going to mention him here because I don't think it's appropriate, but someone I think he's got tremendous kudos, and therefore I think he's the fact that he's doing it as a one-time, he's on his second startup having sold the first one very successfully. You know, he's demonstrated this kind of stuff really can really work. So I think that's definitely a hugely powerful thing. Really kind of works in the technology arena. Would it work in other categories? You know, other industries like financial professional services? Maybe it'd just be harder to get people to do stuff, but you're tapping into that passion that technology users have for the technologies that they use and rely on every day. I guess it's the, you know, it's that old cliche of Salesforce moniker, you know, build movements, not monuments. You know, you're galvanizing the reliance that people have on the technology that you're using to make good marketing capital and great. That's just a wonderful virtuous circle.
So it's interesting you bring up kind of Salesforce, and obviously they've created, you know, Disneyland for B2B. But they are very much in technology world, and it's a obviously founder driven company, and the founder is kind of the consummate marketeer in his heart of heart. It's kind of a marketing led company versus, like, say, Oracle, maybe sales led. It's kind of in its DNA. But outside of technology, which you brought up several times, technology companies tend to do things. Where do you see innovating in the B2B marketing space? And why are they innovating there? Like, technology companies, we kind of get it. They know how to buy software. They come to maybe selling to a little bit more technical and kind of universally large audiences. But you know, what about other spaces where innovation?
Well, so I certainly see the professional services sector has transformed itself in terms of its marketing competency and efficiency, and consequently elements of innovation as well. Now, there's probably an argument that could you separate them from the technology sector because they're using technology and often they're consulting on technology projects. So are they're arguably?
Well, let's remove the Accentures of the world and TCSs and people that are into IT services.
Yeah.
And let's say, so, like, other parts of professional services.
Well, in other parts, I mean, less so, because I tend to see the stuff in the bigger organizations, the Capgeminis, the PwCs, the EYs. You know, at a more granular level, you know, we don't, in terms of a lot of my window on the world is looking at the entries to the B2B Marketing Awards, which is the largest program for B2B marketing excellence anywhere in the world, as far as we know. And so I see entries there. You know, a lot of, we don't get a granular level entries from as many lower tier professional services firms we might like, I think it's kind of like the big four or five are up here and the rest of the market's kind of down here.
They're kind of
I can't quantify that. I think they invest in things like thought leadership pretty well, because they know they need to have a point of difference because they're selling their insight. But in terms of some of the innovative stuff in the middle, I'm not seeing that. It might be happening, but kind of tend to doubt it. The other area that I probably identify in terms of, but again, it does blur with your point around technology, is the kind of what cyber area, cybersecurity, which is a massive category. It's grown enormously, multifaceted, but it is essentially technology as well. So can you separate that? Depends on your definition. Beyond that, I don't really see a great deal of those are the main pockets of innovation. Otherwise, it's very kind of brand by brand. You know, there always tends to be an alignment with your technological savvy, and then your ability to do interesting things or in marketing, because the two things tend to go hand in hand. Although, having said that, I've entered into a world where the primary marketing channel at the moment tends to be events. Right now, we've never been so focused on events as we are right now as an industry. Partly because of the over indexing on digital, I suspect.
And so in this context, and I want to come back a little bit to kind of the laggards in a second, but it's so back to events. So part of the reason for events is because digital is oversaturated. Everybody's running. Even LinkedIn is no longer as personal, and you know, there's a feeling that it's being automated. And so you don't know who to trust. You want to look somebody in the eye, and then that you follow up digitally. Sort of, is that kind of the gut level?
Yeah, and LinkedIn themselves are, you know, they, not a week goes past where I don't see they leverage the agency community to sell LinkedIn advertising. So they are and enabling agencies to run events at their offices. There's not a week goes past where there's not another B2B marketing agency event at their London office. I don't know if that's the same in Paris, the same in San Francisco, but it's certainly true over here. And so they rely on events, even though they're selling digital advertising. Yeah, the whole thing's wrapped up together. And LinkedIn is the definition of of an overwhelm, if there ever was one, as far as I'm concerned. The amount of content being created on there is extraordinary. And I know I'm contributing to that, but
Well, yours is quite quality, which is why
oh, you would
you're
say that. Thank you, Alex. You're very kind.
Well, so on that, so actually agencies, so you brought up agencies, and that was my one question. So we have this notion that agencies are supposed to be evaluating innovation, and then bringing that innovation when it's appropriate to their clients. Ironically, like I found some of the agencies that we worked with not particularly innovative, and they are curious, maybe to take a meeting, but actually themselves are still, doing some things in a fairly old-fashioned way. And then I think they also feel a lot disorganized, more disorganized relative to, more purposeful campaign. And so what's your take on like agencies as a A1? Like, do they need to change themselves dramatically to survive? Or well, probably that's question B, but first A is like, what's their role in dispersing innovation, and who's doing that well, and who's not really picking up on that?
I loved your point, by the way, about just now about they're good at talking about it, but not necessarily always good at doing it. And I really really that really resonates with me. I'm such a agency B2B agency community, particularly in London, but also in the States, have been I've always been brilliant partners for us. And so and I've got some very good friends who work agency side, and I think they're just fantastic people, and I respect what they do. But the category is going through massive challenges at the moment because of AI specifically, but also the kind of general economic kind of slowdown, I suppose, or just slow go slow rather than we slow down. It's just kind of slowed up, and certain political decisions or don't help that easing things up. But moving on from that, I think that to your point around they talk about innovation, they always do it. That's definitely true. They don't necessarily always do it. And one of the challenges is that I think, if you're a hammer, everything tends to look like a nail. And they have business, they have ways of making money out of things, and they understand how a client wants this, and I can give them that. And I know if I give them that, then that's my return. Whereas if I try and do something I don't understand or haven't done before, I'm not going to make a guaranteed return, and I'm going to get in trouble either with my shareholders, my boss, or worse, financial trouble. And I've been in that situation as at B2B marketing in my role. People want to do an innovative approach, an innovative solution, and you end up delivering something which actually costs you money, and then therefore that's a terrible situation to get into. So I can respect how that happens. So yeah, it tends to be that there is a what comes sometimes happens that they kind of follow an established path. And again, LinkedIn advertising is a good way of doing this, right? And then I'm gonna, I know for a fact that LinkedIn pays huge backhanders to agencies for spending advertising money on their platform. And it's not reported, not discussed, but they pay a significant kickback for everyone. So the B2B marketing is very exposed to LinkedIn advertising, too much so, I would say. And part of that is because LinkedIn are bribing people, essentially.
What are these, Joel, you have an insider perspective that a lot of folks don't. Like some people are, let's say you're a tech CEO, you've never really been, expert in B2B marketing. All of a sudden you realize, if you can't create a, you create a building product that, is not getting to the market. What are these sort of few tips of advice that you would have that are sort of uncommon wisdom that's not obvious, so like the incentives of the agencies, beware if you're buying your agency, you need to ask possibly like, hey, how much are you getting back from LinkedIn or whatever you're selling, right? Like other tips that you would give to a purchaser of B2B marketing services or technology.
Well, I think that you need, there's a lot in what you said, Alex, so I'm going to try and navigate through that. And one of the things is I think what the kind of proposition you set up was correct me if I got this wrong, but a CEO perhaps wasn't very marketing savvy and was trying to was wanted to do marketing but didn't know his start and was worried about making wrong decisions. I think if you're talking about using agencies, I mean, I'm never going to say don't use agencies. I think they are fantastic. There are so many great agencies and they're responsible for such a great work. But at the same time, I think you probably need someone to hold your hand in that process. And if you don't have a marketing person in your team, well, the number of the growth in fractional marketers or leaders is extraordinary in recent years. And it's partly because it's all for all sorts of reasons. It's partly because the insecurity in the job market. There's lots of great people out there who you can bring in to offer you strategic advice to ensure you make the right decision and to remove a portion of that risk. I'd advise that kind of thing to do that, to try and work with a fractional or some kind of consultant to help you frame the strategy and the objectives and the measurables, and then choose the partner to deliver that. And then also be at arm's length, or at least not necessarily running the campaign, but be available to help you troubleshoot if things are happening.
Right.
Too many. Sorry, go on.
Well, to kind of build on that, like sort of let's connect, because you're right. There are two questions kind of baked in there. One is like you're relatively new to buying marketing, and two, what are sort of these kind of hidden secrets that people kind of falter on, right? So let's say like get a guide, like Joel, by the way, everyone who could guide you through some of these decisions. But like some obvious ones, right? Like you're just starting out and people are offering you a bunch of brand marketing things, right? Which is probably a misplacement of your efforts in my view, right? That I just illustrated, because actually you need to figure out, where demand is, well, who is your great customer that's say, hell yeah, I love your service. And only then, once you figure that out, then you like better off to start investing in brand and how to get to that customer, et cetera. So things like that, like what are other kind of hiccups that you see either marketing teams or CEOs, like you mentioned, make that, because there's a lot of glory. There's, you've seen all of these folks come to your events, and some of the stuff is amazing, but at a different stage in the business, right? For later stage businesses. So, what do you see like as misconnects where people are spending a lot of time on marketing and getting very little out of a lot of time, a lot of money on marketing, getting little out of it? What are kind of the wins that you see people getting, but not spending enough, at least at this point in time, right? Like 2025, 2026, maybe
Well, I think it
2030.
depends on your trajectory as an organization, right? And your point about brand. I mean, let's just be clear about this. You have a brand if you've invested in it or not, right? I mean, the question is, what's enough? What's your baseline level that you need to have formalized it in what way to give you a platform to then do demand generation? And that's basic things like kind of your assets, your logo design, and your website, all those kind of things. Because I just it's and I don't you can't kind of shortcut that to a level. And I'm not gonna there's no kind of hard and fast you need X, Y, and Z. A brand consultant or a fractional CMO will give you advice on that. But it's what I mean, Jeff Bezos is attributed as saying, although I think I've heard it said before, he was attributed to saying, which is your brand is what everyone says about you when you're not in the room. And that's exactly true. So how are you understanding what that actually is and how you're aligning with that? So once you presuming you've got that baseline which you're happy with, well, then it's about, okay, what's your kind of and it depends on what kind of business you are. It depends on kind of the speed of your buying cycle and the churn of your customers, and how do you need to demonstrate effectiveness in that? And it might be that it's an e-commerce approach, which is going to be very different to a longer term sales cycle. Getting what I think that you have to have a kind of there's a point where you'll need to have someone in marketing on the ground who understands this, who can kind of pull the right levers. I guess one of the things is to not make reckless short-term decisions that you end up regretting, whether it's in terms of brand or as it's in demand generation, and to try and understand when you're going to achieve success, when this investment is going to return. And if you need it to return in 3 months, then it's very different if you're going to need it to return in 9 months. And often you're if you're a CEO investing in brand advertising, if they need to see a return in 3 months' time, is a very poor decision. So have a contract, with someone who has authority, whether that's ideally that's someone who's got strategic marketing brain and someone who's responsible for managing the campaign and an agency or a service provider, and make sure it's robust and deliverable using existing benchmarks and previous experience.
So what I'm hearing is, first of all, understand what kind of business you're in, right? And obviously the stages, but generally the challenge is that if you start listening to some random marketing podcasts and events, and you start misapplying advice from more consumer e-commerce world to B2B world, where while there are some similarities and they're merging allegedly, you need to be very clear about who you're in and what kind of advice is appropriate to you. And then once you're there, even there, it's like, well, okay, fine, but what's your time frame, right? And you need to really be very clear that if you have 100% of a pie, what percentage of it can you allocate to those long-term returns that may be disproportionate, but 3 years from now versus short-term? Is that kind of capturing this topic? I know it's a vague question, but I generally feel like I've been guilty of reading some great, marketing book or interviewing an expert like yourself and then saying, oh, I got to use that. And then if I use it, but with my expectations are not set and it's kind of not clear where it fits in the story, I think it creates sort of misalignment to your point. So I think that's probably pretty common for people to not go with horizontal advice is kind of the...
But don't stop getting educated. Don't stop getting excited about things, right? Because when you read a great marketing book or listen to a great podcast, hopefully you take away a nugget of information. It all adds to your kind of general canon. But what we don't want is random acts of marketing. We want a considered strategy with a robust set of objectives.
So on that note, you've hosted the various events for decades now. What are some of the things that are memorable experiences for you, memorable nuggets that kind of you still carry with you, other than Jeff Bezos' quote that obviously we don't know whether it happened or not, but there's things that stick, right? And you've created moments of these learning for others. What are your moments from running the program for so many years?
As I said to you, the buzz that you get, generally speaking, is always really powerful. I think when you stood up on stage and delivered something, a presentation, a session, and you've gone out on a limb to say, I think this is, like last Ignite event, I did a session on consumer grade entertainment in B2B, to be your point, or on the blurring boundaries in B2B and B2C. I went out on a limb on that one, and I got, when you get feedback, so I really like that. That was fantastic. And personally,
there was something at stake. So to interrupt, you're like, it's not, if you say something that's not that controversial, even if people agree with it, you know that it's not that controversial.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're going, you feel like it's risky, and I'm like staking something there is more.
Yes, I agree to a certain extent. I would say it doesn't have to be controversial; it just has to be new, or novel, or they haven't considered before. So it's about changing people's perspectives. And I get a kick out of being somebody who I've really, it's my life's work. I've been doing this for over 20 years, right? I can't really remember a time I wasn't thinking or focusing on this. So when somebody comes up to me and says, Joel, you've really helped me. I really appreciate your perspectives, even if I don't agree with them all the time, because I get stuff wrong. You're only as good as the inputs you're getting, and sometimes it's not right or wrong. It's just shades of grey. So whenever I get that, and whenever I get invited to go on a podcast like this, it makes me tremendously gratified and pleased and grateful to be working in a collaborative environment which we all do. It's such a wonderful space. I can't help saying how gratified I've been to be part of it for all this time.
Well, as we wrap up, one of the biggest changes to the space, obviously, is the prevalence of AI everywhere in marketing. What are your thoughts from pattern matching? Because you've seen sort of the SaaS trends and technology trends and creation trends of various kinds. What do you see that other people probably can't pattern match from the past, and your observation from all the folks that you meet through your podcasting and the events?
Well, that's a really big question. I'm really glad that we got to half an hour into the podcast before you mentioned the word AI. That's we should feel give ourselves a
That's
pat on the back
unusual.
for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I do think I feel like it's not that we're over AI, but I'm overwhelmed, bored with just another post on AI. I feel like I think the what's the parallels between or the comparisons between perhaps that this wave of transformation and the transformation that happened about 2007 when all the marketing automation came in, the demand generation wave with Eloqua and Marketo. That was a really big shift, right? And I think that it's interesting to see how perhaps the Gen Xers or the early millennials who lived through that seem to be coping better with the transformation that's happening now. And partly it's because they're later in their careers and they've just seen more water under the bridge, but also they've seen this particular type of water go under the bridge and they know they have to reinvent themselves for a new era and that they're pretty busy doing that. Whereas perhaps you've got younger generations, and I'm not suggesting that one kind of cohort is better than another. That's a ridiculous thing to say. Everyone has basically is a and they're, by definition, these cohorts are meaning so generalized it's ridiculous, but the experience and the kind of the digital savvy of more younger employees is always incredible and impressive, but the perhaps the resilience and the willingness to the appreciation of the need to change and the willingness to do that and the that kind of recognition is different, and in some ways that's nice. It's a bit of a leveler. We're all starting again from scratch. And I think I like the fact that I feel like there's a bit of maturation of the AI discussion to be less around, oh my God, we're all going to lose our jobs, to okay, we recognize this is a big shift. It's going to change a lot of things, but there's going to be just as many opportunities at the end of it as there were at the beginning. We've just got to navigate that. And what worked in the past isn't going to be what works in the future. The difference between back taking back full circle, the difference between that and the marketing automation revolution is it happened quite slowly. It happened over a period of 5 years for some companies, and whereas this is happening really fast. And it's kind of, we're all getting whiplash.
And do you feel like on that, like as we wrap up, so what's going to happen with the marketing automation workflows? Because some organizations still want the leads, right? Like we still see, well, maybe not as much excitement about the Adobe and Marketo and whatnot, but there's still, when there's a choice between getting a gated lead from some content asset versus ungated, a lot of people go down the gated path because the incentives are aligned that way. What's your thought on that?
I think that the MQL is logically, it should be dead, but it's still here, it's still with us. And to your point around compensation, I'm not sure it's the word you used, but that was in what your intention is aligned around that. But also, that's what the CFO understands.
Yes.
It's a number on a spreadsheet, and brand engagement, or however you measure it, isn't the same number. So they can't relate to that. So, I think the most nuanced perspective I had on this was a senior marketer, Kate Mackey from EY. I was interviewing her kind of a few months ago. She was saying, it's still a currency which has some value, and marketing has to navigate around it. I think most marketers probably would get rid of it if they could, but there are still a lot of people who still rely on it. I don't quite understand some of the reticence, but this, I mean, one of the interesting on a technological level, right? Marketo, Eloqua was a brilliant product and brilliant brand that was killed by Oracle, right?
Yes,
Absolutely,
yes, yes.
much lamented. As a brand, it was great, and everything it stood for was great, and they just took it, bought it, integrated it, and killed it. Whereas Marketo still exists, even though Adobe, and I have this from a power user's mouth, that they've been trying to kill it, and they just recognize they can't kill it because it has a real solid user base of people that still love it. And even though they've been trying to kill it by a thousand cuts, they've kind of recognized that there's some people out there, as to his words, still bleed purple. And they've got to keep investing in it, or keep it alive for, you know, a significant time to come. And that must mean that it's baked into business processes and a lot of organizations, and it's doing a good job. So I think as long as you have that technology around and you have the CFOs still understanding what MQL is,
yeah,
I think we're going to see that mindset persist for some foreseeable future, even if the smart money means moving away.
Yeah, and as we wrap up, with one of the patterns that I see is people are definitely maximizing what they could do with that technology. So they're delaying the gating much more. And so we've been brought in because we could delay the gates on the Marketo. And so that is kind of, you reduce friction or increasing the experience so that it converts directly to meetings, adding chat capabilities. So you're actually having a sales conversation, you know, right inside your gated Marketo asset. So it actually converts to the other metric that the CFO understands, which is a booked meeting. So it's not like, I don't want to position it as black and white. We do see innovators, you know, try change, adapt the workflow, but it is pretty limited in, you know, in terms of the legacy of the technology. And so I think that that's going to be the killer is probably that it's just tough to adapt something that was built in 2007 originally.
And you can see that. I mean, I understand again from the marketing technology. I'm involved in a think tank, and the sort of Adobe and Salesforce were both really pushing down the account-based marketing route because, you know, they don't want to be in this MQL game. John Miller, who set up Marketo, is saying there's got to be more to life than MQLs. That's my words, not his, but that's essentially the crux of it.
Yeah.
So I think this, it's only going one direction, but it's not going that fast.
Brilliant. Joel, loved connecting. Thank you so much for sharing your nuggets. Where can people find you and continue to learn from you? Your podcast.
Well, thank you, Alex, for inviting me on. I'm delighted to have this conversation. Really enjoyed it. You can find me on LinkedIn, look for Joel Harrison. You can search me online, Joel Harrison B2B, for my website there. You can subscribe via that, via my website, or via anywhere you get your podcast, Spotify or on Apple, or indeed you can subscribe, follow me on YouTube. The podcast all available there, and lots of other content as well besides.
Joel Harrison, B2B. Thank you, Joel.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relateto.com, relateto.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relateto.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.